You're tuned to a special rebroadcast of Swimming Upstream, KPLU's fall series on salmon migration. So if you missed the return of the fish this year, now's your time to relive the journey. I'm Gabriel Spitzer.
And I'm environment reporter Bellamy Palethorpe. In this hour, we'll follow the Lake Washington Chinook Run, starting out on the ocean where we'll meet a veteran fishing guide.
I caught my first salmon when I was 5 years old, and I'm 68 now. My wife sometimes puts it akin to buffalo hunting.
Also, the daunting trip through the Boward Locks in Seattle.
You see fish milling around outside of the downstream entrance to the fish ladder, and not to anthropomorphize, but, you know, it looks like they're saying, do we really have to do that? It's so hot.
And spawning grounds on the Cedar River.
I have hope because I have firsthand seen the resiliency of the Chinook salmon, and they are a mighty, beautiful, amazing creature.
That's coming up on this special presentation of Swimming Upstream. Welcome to this special presentation of Swimming Upstream from KPLU. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and I'm joined by environment reporter Bellamy Palethorpe. Bellamy, we're about to hear a lot about salmon. What is it about salmon that is so associated with the Northwest? Why is it such an iconic creature for this part of the country?
Well, I think, first of all, Gabe, it is our best source of indigenous food. Historically, Native peoples got tremendous amounts of nutrition from this creature. And even today, I think people really enjoy eating a food that they feel like is imbued with the local landscape as it swims through our streams. Secondly, if you've ever been anywhere where spawning fish are coming upstream, it's just incredible. First, you hear them coming. You hear the splashing sound, and then you can witness these salmon just jumping up over rocks and through pools, and you just notice how powerful they are and the incredible drive that they have to go home and spawn. And it's just an amazing sight to see, and I think those things really are unique to the Northwest and just capture people's imagination and make us identify with them as a symbol of our home.
Yeah, they are a pretty important resource, both today and historically. I mean, they kind of made life possible here in this part of the country in a lot of respects. And the charisma of this animal in its long trip home that you alluded to, and we're about to follow it, how is that trip unique in the animal kingdom? And what is it about that that conjures so much myth and so much drama?
Well, the salmon are born somewhere in a stream, somewhere in the Northwest. They become imprinted as they are coming out of the gravel and moving downstream as tiny juveniles, you know, barely bigger than your hand. And as they travel along, they pick up all of these signals. They go out to the ocean. They're there from 2 to 5 years, and then they come back and they have this amazing ability to find their way back based on the smells of their natal streams. And once they start moving, a clock is ticking. They basically stop eating. It's like a pilgrimage to Mecca. And their one and only purpose is to get back to their place where they will go home, procreate, and die. And it's just an incredible almost like a mythological kind of story. And it's the life cycle of a creature that is biologically extremely well evolved.
And it does seem, extraordinary when you think about, put yourself in their little fins for a second and imagine yourself in the open ocean where all you see around you is undifferentiated water, to know what direction to go to get to the coast, to know what direction to go from there to get to the mouth of the right river, then to know where the right tributary is, then to know where the right little extra special space where your lineage springs from. It's an extraordinary thing for a relatively small-brained creature to figure all that out.
It is amazing. And furthermore, each individual fish run evolves on some level tailored to the stream that they're going back to. So, for example, the Elwha salmon, who had these huge waterfalls to move up, were huge, historically speaking.
Until they're big fish.
Very big fish. And, you know, another salmon run in a slightly mellower area might be smaller, but they are tailored to the place that they came from. And it makes each one of them somewhat unique. It's hard to even say how many native salmon runs we have because they're actually grouped into these units of evolutionary significance. So you can see that there are many, many different runs of salmon.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's just extraordinary how well adapted they are to their individual habitats. But that also makes them vulnerable in some sense when those habitats get shifted around or changed, say, by human activity development, climate change, etc. So what has happened to the salmon population of the Northwest over the years?
Well, they've declined. In 1999, when they were listed in the Puget Sound region, they had gotten to a point where basically the federal government decided that they were at the brink of extinction if we didn't start working really hard on it. And I remember I was living abroad at the time. I grew up here, but living abroad, and I heard this news. And initially, my reaction to that was kind of sad. Oh my gosh, you know, we've gone this far that we've really run this creature into the ground. Since then, I've come to realize that the listing is a good protective tool and means that a lot of people are working very, very hard on bringing these fish back. And they are remarkably resilient. That's something I learned in the course of the series, and we'll hear more about that. But as you were saying, many of these fish travel hundreds and hundreds of miles, and there is so much that can go wrong along that area. It all has to line up and work well for a fish to go from a tiny fingerling or a tiny little hatched out salmon all the way out to the ocean and come back and make it home.
Well, to mark 15 years since that listing, we embarked on this series. Well, you did. I didn't. I was here dry at home. But on this series, marking their progress from the open ocean back to their natal stream. Why did you want to tell the story this way?
I've been reading a lot of books lately that are road trip style books, and you see road trip movies, and there's something inherently compelling about going on a trip from one place to the next. You really want to know what's going to happen. So initially I was thinking, you know, there was so much going on in the world of salmon this summer. We were hearing about record returns on the Columbia, tremendous successes with sockeye salmon in the Okanagan Basin, and, you know, kind of cross-border cooperation in fishery practice leading to tremendous returns. And I was thinking, well, you know, how is this going? What is really happening here? And then I realized, you know what, it would be really fun to actually just focus on one salmon run, use it as an example of how challenging it is to restore habitat all along the journey and make sure that everything goes right so that the fish can actually return home.
Well, where do we start?
So I focused on the Lake Washington Chinook Run. It's interesting to me because it runs right through the center of Seattle. And the place where we were able to start out on the open ocean is a small fishing town called Siquiu. It's about halfway between Nia Bay and Port Angeles, just a tremendous place where you arrive and you can just smell the fish in the air. The gulls are always hanging around on the dock with the fishing boats, picking up the scraps of people's fishing adventures. I went there and met with a veteran fishing guide. His name is Roy Morris, and he's with Able Guide Service.
All right, we're about to hear him talking with KPLU environment reporter Bellamy Palethorpe in part one of Swimming Upstream.
We're out here where the Strait of Juan de Fuca joins the ocean, about 10 miles east of Nia Bay. You can see the open water. There have been a handful of fishing boats passing us, and we have seen some fish jumping, but it's actually remarkably quiet out here for this time of year.
Yes, it is. It's surprisingly quiet. Usually one of the peak times of the year is right now. People just haven't been catching that many, so there's not that many people.
Why is that, do you think?
Well, for years we've seen declining stocks. Certainly there's up and down years, but this year has seen less catches on the dock that I've moored my boat for 20 years. People are reporting as it's the lowest year of catches for salmon, particularly Chinook.
This is surprising to me because I've seen the headlines about the Columbia River fishery. There, the Chinook run is at an all-time high, 1.5 million fish projected to come back. Yet, at the same time, the same year, you could have a Chinook fishery here that's so low.
It is surprising because I know there's many people working together to try to improve conditions and survival for salmon, but it's up and down from year to year within a decade. This year is some of the lowest catches for Puget Sound Chinook that we've ever witnessed.
And Chinook salmon, king salmon, what is it about this particular fish that is so alluring?
It's the largest, and to most people's taste, it's the tastiest. And it's because it chored higher and higher into watersheds and were the long distance runners in the Columbia River. They went by the whole state of Washington up to Canada. Here in the Puget Sound, they go right to the North Cascades. And the Puget Sound wild salmon are the icon of the Northwest. Everybody likes silvers and sockeye, certainly, and chum have their place, and humpies have their every odd year season. But Chinook salmon, called the king because it's just the biggest and most spectacular. And
they really pull.
They're a formidable fish. That's probably one of the reasons people like them the most.
And the fish at this point in their life cycle, they're getting ready to go back upstream and spawn. Their behavior changes. They get harder to catch. Is that right?
Right. There's slang talk like lockjaw, and more formal talk is wading fish. They're not so much chowing down to build their body. They have built stores in their body from feed, and now their body starts to change in a metabolitic process where reproductive capabilities are being developed more than muscle tissue. And as that chemistry changes, their desire to return to the natal stream and spawn overrides their desire to hunt and feed and hunt and feed.
So they're harder to catch.
Much harder to catch.
And now you've been fishing since you were a young man. How does this compare to those days?
I caught my first salmon when I was 5 years old, and I'm 68 now. My wife sometimes puts it akin to buffalo hunting. You know, there were a lot of them, and anyone could do it, and now there aren't so many of them. It was so crowded in El Waco that you couldn't get a boat moorage, you couldn't get a place to fish.
When was that?
Late 50s and early 60s. It just burgeoned to be in a sport that working-class people had enough disposable income to buy a boat and camp for a week or two at the coast, and it became a choice of many people to have that be their family vacation because it came with a bounty of fish that were canned and smoked and frozen. Now we have only one Chinook salmon in the freezer, where last year we had about 15, so we'll be fishing hard to get the rest of the fish.
And yet, we do still see fish returning. We're following Lake Washington Chinook. They do even return all the way up at the Cedar River and spawn.
The Chinook is one of the more fragile of the spectrum of salmon in the Northwest. It requires an overwinter, longer freshwater experience, which exposes them to nearshore human use and the effluent from that, which is toxic to them oftentimes. But where barriers are removed, they're amazing the way that they'll try to fight for their own survival if they're given half a chance. And one of my most joyous stories is seeing the efforts to have fish return to Issaquah Creek. Now that's a celebration with booths and festivals and people hanging over bridges and seeing fish where at one time those stocks had dwindled to just such small numbers. People had never even seen them or knew they were in the river. Now they throng, and there's a celebration that will be happening this month in Issaquah that just is testimony to if you give them a chance, they will survive.
Roy Morris with Able Guide Service in CQ Washington. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you very much. Grateful for the opportunity to get people more information about fish.
So, Bellamy, from the open ocean, the fish have to make their way back in the direction of land and toward Lake Washington, their namesake. So where's their next stop?
Well, they're arriving in Puget Sound, which is really where we start to get into that transition from salt water to fresh water. And this is also a place where they face basically a stew of toxic chemicals. You know those little stencil things that you see on storm drains around town?
Drains to sound or whatever.
Puget Sound starts here.
Right, right.
Well, that's partly because of what we're about to hear about. We're going to talk with Sandy O'Neill. She's a research scientist with the State Department of Fish and Wildlife, and she has worked on toxics and how they affect fish and specifically Chinook salmon.
Well, we're about to hear how those Chinook salmon react to their first brush with a highly human-influenced environment here on the second installment of Swimming Upstream from KPLU.
And we're floating on a boat here in Shilshol Bay where we can see the crush of urbanity, all these homes, people's structures lining the shores superimposed on top of the fish habitat. Sandy, how does the king of salmon, a big Chinook, experience this kind of environment?
Well, the main thing these fish are doing right now is swimming through it on their way home. The Puget Sound is a very unique place because it is a deep inland fjord. It is one of the only inland fjords along the whole west coast of America that's in an urban setting. And so the fish that go out through Puget Sound and then come back through it experience a much more urbanized setting than any other fish up and down the west coast.
The toxic chemicals kind of get trapped in here, do they not? It's like a dirty bathtub that's hard to clean.
So the fjord has these sills at the entrance to Puget Sound, and it creates sort of a bathtub. And so what happens is the waters within Puget Sound doesn't exchange as freely with the waters in the open Pacific Ocean. And there are lots of fjords further north in British Columbia where that you also don't get that exchange, but the difference is they're not developed.
And the clock is kind of ticking on these fish as they make this journey. They don't eat much at this point. It's almost like they're on a pilgrimage of some kind. So anything that delays them can affect their survival and whether they have the energy to make it home to spawn.
Right. So these fish are the lucky ones that have survived a lot of the contaminant exposures and they're on their way back. The fish that have come down through the river and out through Lake Washington and the locks and gone onto the Pacific Ocean have been exposed to all kinds of contaminants that can affect their growth, make them more susceptible to disease, things like that. And so that can really reduce their fat content, their size. And so when they come back, the amount of contaminants in their system coming back may or may not affect their survival, but certainly the amount of contaminants in their system on the way out makes a huge difference.
And it's important to note that these chemicals can affect fish survival even in what might look like beautifully restored habitat.
Yes, you can't always see the contaminants that are in the water. And so you may not even be able to measure really high levels. So they can be exposed to really, really low concentrations and you can have quite serious effects, especially like say on a developing embryo, very, very small levels of these chemicals called PAHs, the things that are associated with exhaust from your car. Those sorts of things can affect the development of the heart. It doesn't kill you out right away, but it can affect your swimming speed and ultimately your marine survival.
I'm tempted to make an analogy here about these toxics that for fish swimming through them in the water, it might be kind of like a human spending too much time in a smoke-filled room.
Well, I guess it's an okay analogy. The thing about smoke is it's one contaminant and it's one pathway. It's getting into your lungs and it's, you know, nicotine. The thing about the contaminants for a juvenile salmon in particular, they have to migrate through the soup of a whole different type of chemicals. So in some ways it's quite a bit worse because it's many different chemicals with many multiple pathways to cause injury.
And you found that this pollution you've studied poisons the fish's flesh, which means that they're not so healthy to eat for humans or for orcas, right?
So Puget Sound fish in general have 3 to 5 times higher levels of certain contaminants, PCBs, flame retardants, than other salmon populations up and down the coast. Because it's a deep inland fjord, many fish, probably as much as 30% of the Chinook salmon, can reside in Puget Sound year-round and pick up high levels of contaminants. And orca whales, whose main diet while they're feeding in the Salish Sea is Chinook salmon, can also get exposed to those levels.
Are there any bright spots in all of this for you?
Oh, sure. I mean, you couldn't do this for a living if there weren't bright spots. You'd be terribly depressed. The first thing is that I think people are so much more aware now than they ever have been about how their behaviors affect the quality and the health of the sound. The second thing is that we have a much more regional governance structure through the Puget Sound Partnership. So you have a lot of different groups getting together to try to solve problems. And there are some successes. So we were able to ban PBDEs. This is a toxic flame retardant. That's a great thing. There's great developments with stormwater technology. We're starting to see that we can treat stormwater and get some of these toxics out of there. So I think there's plenty of reasons for hope. And that's just from a toxics perspective. And then there's also all the other physical habitat changes. So I think there's a strong will in the region to make this a better place, and I think it will be.
Sandy O'Neill, research scientist with the State Department of Fish and Wildlife. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Bellamy. It was a pleasure.
Coming up after the break, we'll follow our Lake Washington Chinook as they climb a concrete staircase. That's ahead on this special presentation of Swimming Upstream from KPLU. Thank you. Welcome back to this special presentation of Swimming Upstream from KPLU. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, here with environment reporter Bellamy Palethorpe. And Bellamy, the Lake Washington Chinook have now made their way through Puget Sound, and they are about to confront the front door to the freshwater system here. Where do they find their way into the freshwater here?
Well, they come through that famous landmark that many tourists visit and locals alike, the Ballard Locks. And this is a really interesting structure. First of all, it's one of the most accessible places to go look at fish as they swim through. It's also a tremendous opportunity to hear from a scientist, really from the fish's point of view, what it is like to make that transition from saltwater to freshwater.
Yeah, so they confront this structure. What must it look like to those fish?
I think it's just a bunch of concrete that they're swimming through. And I'm not sure they're looking at it so much as following their noses and the way that the water is flowing. And that's something that's also very precisely engineered to try and help them find their way to the right places, ideally.
So who do you talk to there?
I met with Eric Warner. He's a wonderful fish biologist who oversees all of the research of the Muckleshoot Indian tribe. He's a real character and does a nice job explaining what this is like.
All right, well, let's hear that. This is the third installment of Swimming Upstream from KPLU.
So we're sitting here looking out onto the Ballard Locks. It's kind of like an elevator for boats that are going between the salt water of Puget Sound up into the freshwater of the lake. And there is a fish ladder here that's designed to enable the fish to get through as well. There are windows on it, but it's kind of hit or miss whether you'll actually see very many fish when you go down and look.
Right. They run at different times of the year, and we're getting towards the tail end of the Chinook run and the beginning of coho, but there certainly aren't many fish in there right now.
Why is that?
Well, the Chinook run is a lot lower than we had hoped for this year. It's not entirely done, but it's one of the lowest runs, second or third lowest since we started counting at the locks in 1995.
So the lowest ever was about 4,000?
Yeah, just under 4,000, of which only about 400 were natural spawners.
And that's of millions of fish often brought in by the hatcheries alone.
Yes, it's very variable, the survival of Chinook in this system. There have been a lot of things that have been improved since then, but there are also problems that are getting worse.
And the Lake Washington Chinook have got to be some of the craziest fish in Puget Sound because they are coming up through this hulking structure of the Ballard Locks. They have this instinctive drive to go through, even though it's really pretty treacherous.
Yeah, they have to go through it twice, obviously, once as juveniles, and then the survivors have to go through it again as adults. And there are problems with fish getting eaten by sea lions and harbor seals coming into the ladder.
We see a seal out there right now today feasting on them.
They're obviously looking for a meal on one of the salmon.
That's a pretty common scene at dams all over the region, right? The fish stack up at the bottom of a hydropower structure or a lock, and they become easy pickings for predators.
This is a particularly bad spot because it's right at the interface between saltwater and freshwater. And the saltwater is cold, and it's what the fish are used to. The freshwater is many degrees warmer, and it's a tough transition even without all of the concrete to navigate around.
And they do get kind of banged up as they travel through that concrete sometimes.
Yes. The ones that go through the fish ladder often are dodging sea lions or seals to get in there, and then the entrance can be fairly skinny. And so we see marks on some of the Chinook that we tag just from getting scraped on their way into the fish ladder. And the juveniles going out, they end up going through some of the plumbing and they get more than scraped up. They get decimated.
So these locks officially opened in 1917. This was just a few years after the Elwha Dam was infamously built without any fish ladder at all. This facility had a 10-step ladder. That's been improved upon over the years.
Yeah, the 10-step ladder didn't really work. There was no attraction flow, so basically the fish were very confused about how to get upstream, and they would end up going through the large locks.
Where the boats are?
Yes.
So once they get through and they've gone from the saltwater environment into the lake, what is that like for them?
For Chinook anyway, they've spent their last 2 or 3 years out at sea in cold water. People tend to forget how much salmon need cold water. They're at about 55 degrees for years, which, you know, would give someone hypothermia and kill them within 6 hours. So when they get here and the water is 72, it's a huge shock. So you see fish milling around outside of the downstream entrance to the fish ladder, and not to anthropomorphize, but, you know, it looks like they're saying, do we really have to do that? It's so hot And it's fresh, obviously. So once they get upstream, it's a whole nother world. And we found from our tracking that they can be there for 2 or 3 weeks on average. And the record for our tracking was 53 days. We thought that fish was dead.
A fish stayed for 53 days just milling about here near the lock?
Right. They're basically stuck in a very small area for a very long time, and we think it's largely because the conditions are so inhospitable for them to go upstream.
Sometimes it must seem like a miracle that any get back to spawning grounds at all.
It does, especially coming here on a crowded day. It seems like we're about as far removed from your typical salmon run as it's possible to get.
We'll hear more about that in our next installment. Eric Warner, biologist with the Muckleshoot Indian Tribe, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
So Bellamy, our Lake Washington Chinook finally make it through the locks, through the ship canal, and find themselves in the place they're named after, Lake Washington. What is that environment like for them?
It's a big lake, and the fish actually have a choice. And there are two kinds of fish that come through the locks that are technically Lake Washington Chinook. Some of them will come through and take a left and head up toward Bear Creek and Issaquah, where most of them are hatchery fish, and will return to a hatchery there that's run by the Muckleshoot Indian Tribe. But what I thought would be the more interesting journey to take was to follow the fish that would go down the lake to the south toward Renton, eventually going up the mouth of the Cedar River. And this is a run of fish that's high priority for King County in terms of restoration and also mostly wild Chinook. So that's where we're headed now.
So we're going to turn right, enter Lake Washington, go towards Renton, and straight on till Cedar River, right?
That's right. We'll be right there by the Boeing factories in Renton looking at the fish in the lake.
Wow, that's quite a visual. So who is your tour guide there with you?
The guide here is another fish biologist. His name is Kurt Fresh, and he works for NOAA Fisheries Center. This man knows so much about fish, and he spent hours and hours with me on the phone. In fact, he's the one who really told me that he felt that the Lake Washington Chinook was a poster child for salmon recovery issues. So he's got a lot to say about these fish and how they develop.
Well, we owe Kurt kind of a special debt of gratitude then. We're about to hear him in conversation with KPLU's Bellamy Palethorpe in Jean Coulon Park, right on the shores of Lake Washington.
And we're picking up the trail of the Chinook Run that's named after Lake Washington. We followed the fish through the locks in the last installment. After the ship canal, they reach the lake. What do they do there?
Once they get in the lake, depending on the year, they'll typically sort of go the direction that they're ultimately going to spawn in. And it may take them a couple days to get to the Cedar, for example, or it may take them weeks. They're not feeding by now, so they're basically just sort of holding, swimming. They're burning off their fat.
How are they finding their way home?
Well, once the fish get close to the coast and certainly into Puget Sound, they start using smell. They have very sensitive noses, and they navigate by smell. So they can start picking up fine chemicals in the water that tell them when they're getting close to their natal stream.
In addition to their sense of smell, they're also sensitive to barometric pressure. It's almost like they have a sixth sense of when it will rain, and that propels them to move?
Yes, so a fish is trying to get to its spawning ground at the right time, and one of the right times is when there's enough water for it to spawn in. So many of these populations of fish detect changes in barometric pressure because it tells them to start moving, so they time their arrival when it's raining.
And we're here at Jean Coulon Park in Renton, just on the shores of Lake Washington. And you can see the Cedar River just across the water here. The lower mile of it used to be all wetlands. We paved over that. How have the fish adapted to that change?
Sometimes they don't adapt very well, and other times they do. You have to realize that was one of a set of changes that started when they completed the Ballard Locks. We ended up replumbing the system, and the Cedar River used to flow out to Puget Sound through the Green River and the Duwamish. And what we did was we diverted the Cedar River to enter the south end of Lake Washington. So we diverted the lake, and as part of that, the wetlands that were here got altered. People and commercial interests came in and industrial interests, and we started developing this area.
And, of course, that means we encroach on salmon habitat.
That's correct. And, you know, wetlands are good because of their direct connection to salmon, and they're indirect because they act as giant filtration systems. They produce food that gets exported. They produce things that are part of the food chain. But clearly, fish adapted to this change, and salmon are remarkably resilient. We keep giving them our best shot to knock them out, and they take it and keep coming back.
In the lake, how does the freshwater affect them physiologically?
Salmon has to go through a physiological revolution in order to move from saltwater to freshwater. It's basically dying slowly. It's sort of shutting down, putting as much of its energy into spawning as it has. So for the fish here, it's really temperature that's probably the thing, and dissolved oxygen that are the things that we would be most concerned about, because too high a temperature can kill the fish. Even if it's not high enough to kill them, it can stress them enough and affect their ability to reproduce. And if you get dissolved oxygen levels low enough, it can kill fish.
You said these fish are actually, basically, they're dying as they swim through the lake. It's almost like this mythical story of sacrifice.
Yes, the fish is now focused on only one thing, spawning. If you're a female, you get those eggs in the gravel. If you're a male, you fertilize as many eggs and females as you possibly can. And every ounce of your being is focused on doing that. And as a salmon right now, that is your reason for being. You are using all your resources. You know, you're drawing muscle, you're drawing blood, everything to stay alive as long as you can, to spawn, defend your eggs as long as you possibly can, and then you die.
And they also have this keystone species impact, a greater impact than their body mass in a way, because they deliver all these nutrients.
They are like the connecting tissue in our bodies. They connect the marine landscapes with fresh water, and they connect fresh water with the marine system. And as you said, these fish bring all these nutrients back to fresh water, and when they spawn and die, that gets incorporated into the ecosystem. You know, we might not like smelly salmon, but as those fish decay, the nitrogen and phosphorus get incorporated into the plants in the system, and fish get dragged into the bushes where they die, and they actually act as fertilizer. Bugs eat them. You know, their eggs and the carcass can be eaten by small fish. So they're incredibly important.
Kurt Fresh, NOAA fisheries biologist, thank you very much.
Thank you, Bellamy.
Welcome back to this special rebroadcast of our fall series, Swimming Upstream. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, here with environment reporter Bellamy Palethorpe. And Bellamy, by now, these fish have made it all the way out from the open ocean, through Puget Sound, through the Ballard Locks, into Lake Washington. And by now, they must be able to see the finish line, which is where exactly?
It's on the Cedar River, sort of northeast of Renton, heading out toward Maple Valley.
So that area has changed quite a bit from what many generations of salmon must have been used to. And now, of course, ecologists and scientists are trying to put it back. What is it that salmon like? Like, what makes a good spawning ground for your average salmon?
Well, we're going to hear more about that from a scientist in a moment. But basically, cold water and the right amount of oxygen flowing through the water, the right speeds of water. We headed to an area on the Cedar River that the city of Seattle had bought up as part of its salmon restoration plan to see the first fish that I'd ever seen spawning on the river. And it's quite wild and beautiful, really. Lots of trees nearby.
And kind of raw. I mean, if you think that seeing them climb the fish ladder in the Ballard Locks is compelling, seeing them dig a nest and lay their eggs at death's door, I mean, that's pretty dramatic.
It is, and I don't want to give it away, so we should just get right to it. This is the City of Seattle's fish biologist, Carl Burton, who keeps track of Chinook salmon nests by counting them and doing surveys for Seattle Public Utilities.
Almost home. This is part five of Swimming Upstream here on KPLU.
We're following Lake Washington Chinook, and we've arrived here on the banks of the Cedar River, the spawning ground where it all begins and ends. And we're standing just a few feet from a spawning female, right, Carl?
Yep, she's out there guarding her nest.
What does that look like? She's got kind of a white tail.
Yeah, her tail's white because she's been digging her red. And
the red's a nest.
Yes, and the tail tissue gets rubbed off on the rocks, and by the time she's done digging the nest, she's basically removed all the tissue from the tail, and it's really nothing but the bone structure of the tail. And it turns white, and then she dies. And it's actually kind of an advantage for fish biologists because when the tail's white, you can see it, so it makes it easier to find the reds.
They are amazing creatures. They're not eating at all at this point as they're spawning, and yet they're so powerful digging up the river rocks.
Yeah, the vast majority of their biomass is muscle. They can move rocks that are 6-7 inches in diameter. They've been in the ocean feeding for years, building up that muscle. So when they enter fresh water, even though they don't feed, they've got muscle and they've got fat to live off of while they spawn. And then they lay their eggs. The male moves in alongside them, fertilizes those eggs. They move upstream immediately above where the eggs are, dig another pit, and move the rock downstream with the velocity of the water over the eggs. And they keep doing that until they've got all the eggs out of their belly, and then the female will stay over the red and guard the red from other females so they don't come in and dig up her eggs.
So how long are they actually spawning?
Well, it usually takes them 2, 3, maybe 4 days to actually dig the red. And then the research that I've done shows that they can guard their red anywhere from about 4 days before they die all the way to a little over 2 weeks.
What is it about this setting here on the river that makes it an ideal place for salmon to spawn?
Well, one of the things we have is a lack of urbanization. Natural forest adjacent to the spawning grounds. We also have the right size gravel and the velocity, the flow that females tend to prefer for spawning sites, proper depth. They also like to have cover, so if they're disturbed during their spawning, they have somewhere to go. So you can hear the whitewater out there, and that's where they would go if a predator or if a human being came to try and disturb them.
And these red salmon nests, they're huge.
Yeah, they can get very large. It depends on the size of female that's digging them. I've seen them 30, 32 feet long, but the one just downstream from us is probably about 25 feet long, and at this point it's the biggest red in the river.
How many fish will ultimately emerge from one of these reds?
Well, that really depends on the incubation conditions. Fewer fish will emerge from a red if we have a flood. But what I can say is that the average female in the river is about 2.5 feet long and typically has approximately 4,500 eggs. But a really large 5-year-old female might have up to 6,000 eggs.
So literally thousands of offspring coming from one nest, one red.
Well, again, you know, some of those eggs are not going to turn into actual offspring that emerge from the red. There's predators in the gravel, there's disease, there's bacteria, there's siltation that can cause problems with oxygenation. So I would say if you had 6,000 eggs in a red, you're talking about probably hundreds, and a really good year, maybe 1,000.
And how is this year's Chinook run doing 15 years after the listing?
Well, this year is a down year, unfortunately. The fish return as 3, 4, and 5-year-old fish, typically. The 4-year-olds are the dominant age class. 4 years ago, we had a flood in January of 2011. I think that had a major impact on that cohort of fish. And so this year, they're going to be the weakest age class because the fish were spawned in 2010. They were in the gravel when that flood occurred, and I'm sure there was a very high mortality rate due to the high velocities.
Now, there's quite a bit of habitat restoration work going on the Cedar. For example, reconnecting the river to floodplains. What else needs to be done to improve fish survival more?
Well, I think we need to continue improving the habitat, removing levees, adding large woody debris, planting native plants, trying our best to remove some of the development in the floodplain. But we also need to remain positive. We have to take under consideration that it's taking a long time since Europeans showed up here for these runs to decline. So we should not expect them to bounce back immediately. If we can just be patient, learn from our mistakes, and continue in the direction we're going, I think we're headed in the right direction.
Carl Burton, fish biologist with Seattle Public Utilities, thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Bellamy.
Stick around. Coming up after the break, our Lake Washington Chinook may be home, but we'll find out how a certain select few of them get exclusive access to an even wilder spot. That's coming up on the next installment of Swimming Upstream on KPLU. You're listening to a special presentation of Swimming Upstream, our fall series on salmon migration with Bellamy Palethorpe. I'm Gabriel Spitzer. So, Bellamy, are we there yet? I mean, are we home? Is this it?
Well, we're partway home, but there's a portion of the Lake Washington Chinook Run that goes up the Cedar River that actually finds its way up another fish ladder past a dam and into the drinking water reservoir for the city of Seattle.
And I wonder how this part of the river differs from the lower part of the Cedar River, where we just spent a few minutes.
Well, I mean, if you go to look at the habitat above the dam, you actually have to have a special access pass to get onto these back roads that are really dirt roads, quite wild. And so it's similar to the habitat below, but just far less developed. And what's really interesting, though, is actually seeing the structure that was retrofitted. It was only about 10 years ago that they actually installed a fish ladder at the dam and started really allowing for the passage of these wild fish up past the dam. And so that in and of itself is a very interesting story. And it's another example of kind of the crazy things that we do around here using, you know, trap and haul facilities where we're putting fish into rubber totes and into trucks and even into salmon cannons to shoot them past obstacles and so that they can get to their native spawning ground.
I've got to stop you on the salmon cannon. What is that?
Well, that's a pretty new invention that's just been tested and marketed. It's basically another device to get the fish past a dam so that they can successfully reproduce in their natal streams.
So you got to go to this seldom seen place. Who did you talk to there?
Michelle Kohler. She's a senior fish ecologist with Seattle Public Utilities.
All right. Well, this is our last stop on the long journey home for these Lake Washington salmon. Listen in right here on KPLU's Swimming Upstream.
And we're here on the Cedar River at Landsberg Dam in Maple Valley. Above this dam is a huge, pristine watershed full of great habitat for salmon. But we're standing next to something called a pescalator, where fish come up through a chute and they're sorted. Michelle, what goes on here?
Well, the pescalator is actually just a large spiral. It's about 2.5 feet in diameter that carries water and fish slowly up from our holding pond onto a sorting table. There we can sort the fish by species, with Chinook salmon and most other fish being carried over the dam.
So you are sorting the fish. Why?
We're sorting the fish because we opened up the dam to fish passage in 2003, but we decided that we couldn't allow sockeye salmon above the dam, although we wanted to allow all the other species. Sockeye salmon can do something called mass spawning. Mass spawning could result in a pulse of nutrients from all the carcasses decaying at once, which could negatively impact the drinking water quality. Whereas Chinook and coho and the other species we put about the dam aren't likely to be as numerous, and they spawn, especially coho, over a much longer period of time, so we'd be less likely to get a pulse of nutrients.
I see. So some of the fish that are coming through are, in fact, the mighty Chinook, the Lake Washington Chinook Run that we've been following.
Yeah. In fact, this year we've seen about 180 Chinook at the Landsberg Dam, and that's about in line with what we expected, given that the counts at the Ballard Locks were low this year.
And so they swim up a series of steps here to get to the pescalator, where they're then sorted and either allowed a pass or not.
Exactly. Yeah. The fish ladder here is very much like the ladder at the Ballard Locks. It just doesn't have a viewing window.
Now, they don't actually get to swim once they go through the pescalator. You hand carry them?
Yeah, we hand carry them above the dam. That allows us to interrogate the fish or actually take measurements, take length measurements.
You're joking when you say interrogate.
Well, that's a term that I'm using for taking samples and information on the fish. Yeah, but we don't check their passport or anything like that. But we take their length, we look to see if they're a hatchery fish or not, we check their sex, if they're male or female, and then also for Chinook salmon, we take a piece of genetic material, we take a fin clip, so that can be used for DNA to look at if these fish are producing offspring or not.
And ultimately, though, you're having quite a bit of success. These fish seem to like it once they get up past the dam into this more pristine habitat.
Yeah, in fact, we kind of call the habitat above the dam a Shangri-La of sorts. It's 21 miles of river habitat, and it's all within the Cedar River Municipal Watershed, and that's a 90,000-acre drainage owned by the City of Seattle and managed solely for water quality and conservation. So especially given these fish have swum all the way through the very urban Seattle metropolitan area, once they get up here, you know, they might kind of be breathing a sigh of relief. not to personalize it too much, but it's a different habitat up here. It's not impacted by deforestation and urbanization and dikes and levees and things like that.
But they do have to kind of run a gauntlet here to get up to that promised land, that Shangri-La.
Yeah, the ladder is a pretty safe and effective passage, but all salmon have to run the gauntlet. I mean, they literally are swimming upstream, and unfortunately now that's become a metaphor for salmon recovery as well.
What gives you hope in all of this?
I have hope because I have firsthand seen the resiliency of the Chinook salmon, and they are a mighty, beautiful, amazing creature, and they are still doing it, again, despite all the odds. They're still coming back to the Cedar River year after year after year.
So you're very hopeful, it sounds like, but what keeps you up at night?
I guess what keeps me up at night are the things I can't control. You know, the rest of the habitats that these fish experience. And one of the things that's the hardest to grapple with is climate change and how changing weather and temperature conditions could drastically impact this run of fish and all of our salmon runs, actually, in ways that we don't even understand yet. You know, they could slightly alter the food web in the ocean, and that could completely change things for these fish. Warmer temperatures could also continue to push the fish farther northward into colder waters. So we really need to get a better handle on climate change, and in my opinion, we're not doing enough about that yet, and it's going to impact resources we care so much about in the Pacific Northwest, like our Chinook salmon.
Michelle Kohler, Senior Fish Ecologist with Seattle Public Utilities, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well, Bellamy, you tagged along with these salmon on their long trip all the way out from the open ocean out past the Olympic Peninsula into Puget Sound and through the Ballard Locks and Lake Washington and all the way up the Cedar River to their spawning grounds. Were you as exhausted as the fish were at the end of that? I mean, you're still here, so it couldn't have been that bad.
I was actually really exhilarated by it. It's a wonderful thing to be able to do, to actually think about where these fish go as they're on this journey home. It was really fun, actually.
How did you come to think about the fish and their place in the world and in our region?
I think I really gained a new appreciation for the analogies of the earth as a living, breathing being and the role of the salmon within that as kind of like cells in the blood vessels, which are the rivers. Alexandra Morton, a famous fish biologist in British Columbia, talks about the ocean tides being like lungs. And to continue that analogy, the rivers being like blood vessels and the salmon with their keystone species status of delivering all these nutrients up into areas where they wouldn't otherwise go, really play this incredibly vital role.
Now that it's a couple months out from the end of the run, what have we learned about how healthy the run is and how many fish actually succeeded in making that long trip back to their spawning grounds?
Well, this year, the final count of fish spawning in the Cedar River, both above and below the dam, was 580 fish. That's compared to an average of 390 since 1999. So it's upward, but not fantastic for a 15-year period. And the broader context here is that just over half of the historic Chinook salmon runs in Puget Sound, 22 of 37 of them, according to the Puget Sound Partnership, remain. And salmon runs that are remaining are at just 10% of their historic numbers. This is a big issue, for example, for endangered orca whales who prefer Chinook salmon as their food source. So it is a slowly moving upward trend, but still a lot of work to be done.
So encouraging, but still a little bit sobering, perhaps, for the overall recovery efforts. And I think it's worth just reminding us, Bellamy, why this fish is so important to this region, this place that we live, and why it's worth spending so much time and money and effort to restore their habitat and get these fish to thrive again.
Well, these fish really touch so many corners of our world, and the ecosystems that they swim through are all places, generally speaking, where people live nearby. And so if we can restore their habitat and make it healthy, then we'll have a healthier place to live in. And as Tim Egan wrote in his book, The Good Rain, you know, what is the Pacific Northwest? It's any place a salmon can get to. And so if we can help them be healthy, we're helping ourselves as well.
This has been a special presentation of Swimming Upstream, a six-part series on salmon migration from KPLU environment reporter Bellamy Palethorpe.
And hosted by Gabriel Spitzer. Special thanks to our guests and supporters.
Roy Morris and Nancy Messmer of Able Guide Service in CQ.
Sandy O'Neill with the State Department of Fish and Wildlife and Mike Forrester and Barbara Purrington aboard the Alyeska in Chilshoal Bay.
Eric Warner with the Muckleshoot Indian Tribe.
Kurt Fresh at NOAA Fisheries.
And Carl Burton and Michelle Kohler with Seattle Public Utilities.
Thanks also to KPLU News Director Aaron Hennessy, Online Managing Editor Martha Kang, and Production Assistant Malcolm Griffiths.
You can see the whole series online at northwestsalmon.org, where you can read more, podcast this hour, or listen to individual segments. Swimming Upstream is a production of KPLU and Pacific Public Media. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Gabriel Spitzer.
And I'm Bellamy Palethorpe.